is the title of the... Oh, it's okay. So this is based on work with Douglas, who happens to be here, and with Steve Schenker and Lenny Susskind a couple months ago. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about a simple, discrete model of eternal inflation. I think I'm not going to try and convince you why eternal inflation is interesting. Talk to me at pub night if you want that. So the model is, you know, it's exactly solvable, and it captures important features of what we might think of as the real thing, although I guess we don't actually know what the real thing really is, but we have some ideas about it. So I guess the main features that this model has and shares with eternal inflation, so there's an obvious one, which is exponential expansion. And then it has multiple vacua related by decays. And then finally, it has what I'll call in quotes a conformal theory at future infinity. So these are all properties that we sort of either think eternal inflation has, or we sort of want it to have, at least.
Perhaps you could give us a 30-second description of what eternal inflation is.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Okay. So the idea is that you're in some you have some theory where there's some potential, you know, of the universe, which will be multidimensional, but I can't draw it multidimensional, so I'll pretend it's single dimensional. And for simplicity, I'll put all of the minima above zero, which is not realistic, but it's something I'll do throughout the talk, except maybe at the end. And then the idea is that if you start in a region of space where the scalar field is sitting here, then because of the positive energy, the space will be expanding. It's de Sitter space. But the space is metastable, so you can have a decay from this vacua to this one. Or actually, because it's positive, you can even have a decay, we think, upwards, essentially because this space we think of de Sitter space as thermal. And thermal fluctuations can actually carry you up here as well as going down here. And we like to think the rates are related by detailed balance, which is something I'll talk about later. But in any event, the space-time picture you get is that, you know, you start in one of these vacua, I don't know, this one. And then as the space expands, you nucleate bubbles. And then the bubbles themselves are expanding, and then they can nucleate more bubbles inside of them. And you can have collisions with bubbles and more bubbles within bubbles, and they get, you know, smaller and smaller. This is a Penrose diagram here, or a cartoon of a Penrose diagram. And you generate sort of a fractal pattern at future infinity. And the idea is that, you know, string theory seems to say that this is what the low energy theory of the world looks like. You know, cosmological experiment seems to say that there's a positive cosmological constant. We seem to have had inflation in the past. So at least it's some framework that I would at least like to try and make sense of and see if you can really make a mathematical theory out of it. But of course, the real model is too hard, so I'm making a toy model today. Okay. Well, I guess. Oh, yeah, sure. Okay, so in ADS CFT, so if we'd had one of these minima negative and stable, then that would have described, you know, the scalar field sitting there would be a stable solution of anti-de Sitter space. If you draw the Penrose diagram of anti-de Sitter space, there's a boundary over here. And the idea is sort of like if you compute, say, correlation functions in the bulk of anti-de Sitter space and you extrapolate them to the boundary, then you find a conform, you know, they agree with some holographic dual, which is a conformal field theory, which you can use to compute those extrapolated correlators. So in anti-de Sitter space, the boundary is time-like, and there's a Lorentzian conformal field theory living there. Whereas in this sort of de Sitter or de Sitter-like space, The only so these are not boundaries. This is just R equals 0 here. So the space is, there's nothing interesting going on there. But there is a real boundary of the space at future infinity, although the boundary is quite complicated because of this fractal pattern being produced on it. But somehow you might hope that the underlying dynamics still respect something like the de Sitter symmetry, and that there may be some sort of Euclidean conformal field theory living at future infinity, which describes the late time probability distribution in this space. Okay, yeah. So that's sort of the some of the philosophy behind this. Okay. So you might ask if this model is in some sense a consistent approximation to what we think of as the full thing in some limit. It's not in an obvious way. In the paper, we said it wasn't. Ongoing work since then has suggested that, in some sense, it actually is. But I'm not going to talk about that here, because it's not all worked out yet. So for the point of view of this talk, this is just some mathematical structure, the model I'm about to describe, and we're going to work out its properties. Okay, so that's it for my introductory statements. Okay, so now let me talk about the model. I'll start by describing what you might want to call the 2 plus 1 dimensional version. So the idea is you start with some colored square. So say, I don't know, this is blue. And the idea here is that colors are sort of analogous to vacua. And for fun, let's say there's some finite number of vacua, finite number of colors, which we can call NC. So then, if there were only one vacua, if it was only blue, then a way that you might try and describe the exponential expansion in a discrete way is you just say, well, you start out with this square being blue, and then after one time step, you cut it into quarters, and now you have four blue squares, which you sort of imagine as being the same physical size as the original one, and then you can, you know, proceed again. And in this way, you can have an exponentially growing number of these squares, which I'll call cells. So this is called the cellular model. But it's kind of boring if they're all blue. That isn't any fun. So what's more interesting is at each step, after you cut it into smaller pieces, then with some probability, you change the color from blue to something else. And then, you know, you do the step again, and then with some probability you change it again. But this is supposed to be modeling this bubble nucleation, you know. So this is the blue vacuum can decay and produce other colors. And the way that you do it is you say, so this square started out blue, and now it has four descendants, you might say. And with each one of these, for each descendant, there's a probability, I don't know, N from blue, which is the probability that given that this was blue, you change the color of this to N, where N is some other color, red, green, purple. And then, so I don't know, say this is red, blue, blue, blue. So now when you divide again, when you decide what you're going to color this, the only information you use to decide is you look at what its ancestor, what color its ancestor square was. So if this square is red, then for all four of these squares, the relevant thing to compute is gamma n red, which is just some set of numbers. These are the probabilities for you to change the color from red to something else. Whereas for this square, since its ancestor blue, you still use gamma blue going to n. Okay. And it's clear you can run this procedure endlessly, and you'll generate some fractal pattern of colors on this square. So that's the basic setup. I'm going to draw it. So I call this 2 plus 1 dimensional because sort of it's a square, and then it's evolving in time. Just to help with the intuition, I'm going to draw the 1 plus 1 dimensional version as a space-time diagram. OK, so now time, which I'll call u, since it's discrete. So this is u equals 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, going up. And then it's blue here. And then you keep splitting like this. And then how you decide to color this square here only depends on this one, not on these other ones. And you know, similarly for all the other ones. So you generate some, you know, blue, red, red. You know, you can go back to blue from red because I said up transitions were allowed, yellow, green, white, et cetera, going up.
Can you just clarify the second step?
Yeah.
Why do you say, like, if you decide about this red block, how to split it, why is it not influenced at all by what are the neighbors? Like, if it were not blue in the other three, but something else, why is it not influenced?
Well, yeah, this is a choice. So from the point of view of the model, I could just say I'm defining it that way. But of course... Yeah, I do. So that's what I'm. Yeah. So the reason is that in De Sitter space, you can think of these as being like horizon volumes. The number of horizon volumes grows exponentially in De Sitter space, and the idea is that sort of once two guys are outside of each other's horizons, they can no longer influence. You know, what's happening at this point and what's happening at this point. They can't communicate because, you know, any signal they send here will not get into the future light cone of this point. So the idea is that the way that you decide what happens in the nucleation should really only depend on the part of your history which can causally affect you. And in the model, that's just the square that's right underneath you. And that's a good segue because what you can sort of see here, so this both of these squares, so I'll erase the colors as I do this, are influenced by their ancestor. And then the causal structure goes up like this. So it has a tree-like structure. And this is supposed to be modeling the exponential expansion of De Sitter space, the causal structure of De Sitter space, that points can fall out of causal contact. So in particular, this square and this square can never influence what happens in each other's future again. Okay? So is that... Yeah. Oh, well, no. It's a Markov process, which I'm going to say more explicitly in a minute. But so what happened here affects everything here because this affects what happens here, and these two affect, you know, what this one affects what happens here, and this one affects what happens here. So there is a sense in which what happens earlier does affect you, and that's going to be very important in what follows. Okay. So the fun thing about this picture is it sort of makes clear that the dynamics of this model really only care about this tree-like causal structure. So in the way that I'm drawing the lattice, you know, these two points are near each other, are next to each other. But it doesn't really matter. I mean, these two points are also next to each other, but they're closer together in the tree than these two points. So it's not really an accurate, I mean, the way I've drawn this is a little bit misleading, and it seems like this and this are have the same level of relationship. So you can, the sort of way that we've decided to deal with this is you can just think of this model as living on this tree. You can forget about the squares, and you can just say, okay, here's a tree, you know, and it branches up like this, and you can think that the colors are now living on the nodes of the tree, and that this matrix gamma n m, which tells you if your ancestor had color m, then it tells you the probability to change the color to n. And this matrix, along with this tree, completely specifies the dynamics of the model. Okay. So I should say, so naively now, it seems like, so here I was drawing the 1+1 dimensional version. And it seems like to think about the higher dimensional ones, you should imagine that the tree branches 2 to the d times in d+1 dimensions. So this was in 2+1, so one square branched into 4. Which then, you know, branched into 16. But actually, for technical reasons, it'll actually be easier if we just say that the number of times that the tree branches is actually p, where p is prime. Now, I want to emphasize that there is nothing physical about prime numbers here. It's purely, it makes the description of the solution of the model more elegant if I choose this to be prime. But the method of solution could also have been done for 2 to the d or for any other branching number. So I'm not really making the model more or less physical by choosing the branching number to be prime. It's just something that'll be helpful later.
That's the total number of nodes on the last
No, it's so p. So right, the number of nodes grows like p to the u. So if this is u equals 0, there's 1, and then if this is u equals 2, if this is u equals 0, then there's 1 node. And if u equals 1, then there's 2 for p equals 2. So this tree is a p equals 2 tree. Yeah. OK. So now let me talk in a little more detail about the Markov nature of this evolution. OK. So let's define a quantity pn of u. So let's just say this is the probability that some particular node at time u has color n. Okay. Then there's a simple formula you can write for the probability the color distribution of its immediate descendants. Okay. So say it's this one. Then pn of u plus 1 is the probability distribution both for this and for this, given the probability distribution for this. And the equation is simple. So first, nothing can happen. But that's not very exciting. So you can produce n by decaying to it from m. So this is the probability if the ancestor is m, then you decay into n. And that's a positive thing. But then you can also decay out of n into something else. So that's mn pn of u. OK? So this is clearly a Markov equation. And this is the fundamental dynamical equation of this model. It tells you, if I know the probability distribution for some node, then what's the probability distribution for all of its immediate descendants? If you sum over n, it's easy to see that u plus 1 is the sum of pn of u. So the probability is conserved. So that's a good check. Which? Here? This is n. Yeah, so because it's the probability that the ancestor had the color that you want to check. If the ancestor has the color that you want to ask about and it decays, then it no longer has that color, so you get a minus sign. I'll write this this sort of more elegantly as just some matrix G and M acting on PM of U. So now the point of writing it this way is that if this matrix G has eigenvectors, then the solution of this equation is going to be controlled by the eigenvectors, in particular their eigenvalues. And whichever have the, whatever the largest eigenvalues are will be the late time attractors of the solution of this equation. So to solve the model, it's crucial to understand a little bit the nature of the eigenvectors of this matrix. So far I haven't told you anything about G, really. I mean, you can sort of read off what it is from these gammas, but these gammas could be anything. And if the gammas can be anything, then there's not too much we can say about this G, although there are some things you can say. But to make things simpler, and I think, well, not just to make things simpler, but I think because it's physically motivated, I'm going to introduce the condition of detailed balance, which relates the probability of the transition going in one way to the transition going in the other. And the relation is going to be that there exists some entropies associated with the different vacua, or the different colors, SM and SN, such that this is true. Now, whether this is a reasonable assumption about the landscape, well, I think it is, but I don't want to try and get into justifying it here because you run into things that aren't completely well understood. So let's just take it as a sensible thing for a sensible property for a physical system to have. So these S's, they're just parameters in this relation. That's all they mean in the model. It follows from this that the matrix G can be written M MN, where M is a symmetric matrix. So this is just some manipulations with this formula. And then since M is a symmetric matrix, and since this is just a diagonal similarity transformation, it tells you that G has a complete set of eigenvectors. M has a complete set of orthogonal eigenvectors. And then by this similarity transform, you can get all the eigenvectors of G. So now let me just say a little bit about the properties of those things. But I should say first, I'm always going to take this S to be finite. Now, what that essentially turns out to mean is that on this potential, I'm choosing all of the minima to be greater than 0. What it means in this context, though, is that if one of the S's were infinite, then that could mean that you could have a transition that could go in one way but not in the other way. And that's what we would call terminals, which would mean like decaying to flat or ADS vacua, which you can't come back up out of in the landscape. Of course, we think that those things do exist, and we do know how to incorporate them in the model, but it'll make it, well, let's just say the presentation is much simpler if I leave them out. And maybe we can talk about it at the end. You mean in real life? You mean in landscape? Yes. Yeah. It's just a statement about whether instantons exist, right? You can't tunnel out of supersymmetric vacua, but you can tunnel into them. Or at least I think you can. I mean, you can write, if I have a potential, you can write down bounces which do that, where one of the minima is supersymmetric. Okay, but not today. You can't. Okay, so then there are a few properties about these eigenvectors and eigenvalues that I want to say. So first let's define some notation. Okay, so I'm gonna work in terms of the eigenvectors of M instead of G because these are orthogonal and that's convenient. Lambda I will be the eigenvalues either of G or of M. And then this notation just means these are the nth component of the ith eigenvector. So some nice properties. So the lambda I's are less than or equal to 1. There's a unique eigenvector with eigenvalue 0, with eigenvalue 1. So we'll denote that as I equals 0. And its form is that 0, m, is e to the s m over 2 divided by the square root of the sum of the entropies. So in terms of the m eigenvector, it's not very illuminating. But now if I convert this back into a g eigenvector, then this becomes p of 0, of n, is some normalization factor times e to the s n, okay? So this means that all states are weighted by their entropies. And this state we call thermal equilibrium. And because the eigenvector is exactly 1, it's an attractor. It's a stationary point of the evolution. And since all the other eigenvalues are less than 1, it's an attractor. So basically any initial state that you start with, if you wait for long enough, it will evolve into this distribution. What? Sorry, M, this capital M? Yeah, I defined it here. So what is the normalization factor? Yeah. Oh yeah, sorry. It's the sum of the e to the s's, right? Because the probability has to add up to 1. Yeah. Good. So using this technology, you can actually compute all of the correlation functions of this model exactly. Now I'm going to describe that, but I need to take a detour first and talk about in some more detail some of the symmetry property of this tree structure. In particular, since I'm interested eventually in extrapolating the correlators up to future infinity, I need to talk a little bit more about how I describe future infinity mathematically, which is going to lead us into p-adic land. But once I'm done with that, hold this thought. And I'll combine this technology with that technology, and then we'll be able to write down the solution, and they won't be too bad. Okay. I think I may actually start erasing. I mean all the correlation functions at future infinity. Yeah. In some reasonably compact way. Okay. So this tree, it has some obvious symmetry. And that's where the awful I'm afraid I'm to blame for that. So some obvious things are, for example, you can permute these legs, right? You can permute these with each other. There are all sorts of switches you can do up here, which send the tree into itself. And in particular, the definition of symmetry that I'll use is that it preserves the graph distance of any two points on the tree after you act with it. But actually, you can make the symmetry even larger by So this tree, I started at a finite point, and then just, you know, it grows up infinitely this way, but it has some initial point. But the symmetry actually becomes even larger if you allow yourself to consider the infinite tree, which, okay, this extends down, in, I don't know, to China or something. And then this, and then you can keep growing more and more branches out, right, and just going. So this is like you might say thinking about all of De Sitter space instead of only part of it, although that's not a completely good analogy, but good enough. And then it's pretty clear that this will have more symmetry than just the sort of what we might call the compact tree, the one that starts with one point going up. So one particular type of symmetry is you can pick your two favorite points up here at future infinity. And then there's going to be a unique path back through the tree that connects them. I don't know. For these two, it's something like that. And then you can redraw the tree. So you can just take that path and represent it like that. And then now the rest of the tree is just, I guess Lenny calls these bushes, growing out of the tree, infinitely many up this way and infinitely many down this way. And now you can translate the bushes up and down. You can still do reflections inside of each bush. So there's a quite a large set of isometries of the tree. The full isometry group is actually kind of annoying to talk about. Mathematicians tell us that it's an infinite wreath product. I have no idea what an infinite wreath product is. But there's a subgroup of it which we can characterize in a pretty elegant way, and which turns out to be enough to explain the interesting properties of the correlation functions that we find. Unfortunately, to explain that, I have to make one more detour, which is that I have to talk about p-adic numbers. What I want to find a way to describe the future boundary of the tree. This picture is going to be drawn a lot. I'm always drawing the tree where p equals 2, but it's just to make it easier. You can think of a point at future infinity as an infinite string of left-right decisions, right? If you start at some point and you go up, and then you have to choose. Do you go left or right at each branching? So, you know, say we call this dot, and then one way we could call that 0 and 1. So we could call this, I branched to the left here, and I branched to the right here. Here I branched to the left again. Here I branched to the right after branching to the left. And you can keep going up. And it's clear that what you're going to generate is an infinite sequence of zeros and ones, and then a dot. So I can uniquely characterize a point that's in the future infinity of the compact tree, the tree that starts with this point, by giving an infinite series of zeros and ones to the left. This is the way that p-adic integers are represented. They're infinite strings to the left. Now, of course, I could have just drawn them to the right, and then we could have thought it was a real number. But it turns out that the p-adic structure is actually important, so I drew it to the left for a reason. So I should just say very briefly that about p-adic numbers, you can just think of them as these infinite strings, but then you add and subtract them using the elementary school rules. So I'll just, one fun example is you can take the one that is just ones all the way to the left, and you can add it to one. Okay, and I'm in base 2 here, so 1 plus 1 means I have to carry. And this is 0, and then this is 0, and I have to carry again. And then I keep going. So actually, this is 0. So 1's going on to the left is equal to minus 1. So this is the fun of p-adic arithmetic. But actually, this reveals something important, which is that, you know, I would have thought that 1 and minus 1 should have the same absolute value. Whereas if I tried to define the absolute value of this by using the conventional absolute value, it clearly would be much, much bigger than 1. So the way you deal with this is you define a new absolute value, which I'll describe in a sec, which is the p-adic absolute value. And then the p-adic absolute value of this number is indeed 1. Okay. So to introduce that absolute value, I'm going to talk about the distance between two points on the boundary. So this point, as you go all the way up here, is 0. The absolute value of some point is going to be the distance of that point from 0. But I'll keep it general. So let's say talk about the distance between this point x and this point y. So the fun thing about the tree is that for any two points at future infinity, they have a unique common ancestor. You can trace back in the tree and find the first point where they agree. So for these two, the common ancestor is here, whereas for these two, say, I don't know, we can call this W and Z, then the common ancestor is here. And then the idea is that you define the norm, or the distance between them, which we call absolute value of x minus y, to be p to the minus u, where u is the time of the common ancestor, where this is u equals 0, and this is u equals 1. So just to do two examples, the distance between x and y have a common ancestor with u equals 0, so then these guys have distance 1, whereas these guys have a common ancestor with u equals 1, so their distance is 1/2. So essentially, the further up the tree your common ancestor is, the closer together you are in the p-adic norm. Okay. So that's the end of the new material about the p-adic numbers. But I hope constructing it this way, you can kind of see that the p-adic norm captures something very natural about the tree. It captures how far back you have to go to find a common ancestor, which is sort of the way we think that causality should work in De Sitter space. You know, things should only be correlated to the extent that there's some common ancestor in the past that could have influenced both of them. Okay, actually doing well on time. If you ask about this point and this point, the norm is just telling you how far back you have to go on the tree before you find a point that's in both of their past histories. It does, but why don't I postpone the answer to that question? When I write down the correlation functions, it'll be clear that it means something. Yeah. There's one thing about that I can say now, actually. It's an interesting fact, though. So like I said, each two points have a unique common ancestor, which means that you can actually coordinatize the tree by giving a pair of p-adic numbers, and then that uniquely identifies a point on the tree. And it turns out that the graph distance between those two points on the tree, so say you have a point, it's getting busy, so I'll just draw a little version again. So say this point and this point, we'll call this one A and this one B. Then the graph distance between A and B is easily expressed in terms of the p-adic norms of the two guys, of the two points at future infinity, which have this as a common ancestor. So say I have XA and YA are the two p-adic numbers whose common ancestor is A. And similarly, XB and YB are the two guys whose common ancestor is B. Then, so it turns out that P to the graph distance between A and B is given by xA minus yA times xB minus yB over xA minus yB times xB minus yA, and then the p-adic norm of that. Okay? So now we're getting somewhere, because this is a harmonic ratio. And since this is the graph distance between two points, the statement is, I can now make an interesting statement, which is that if I act with the transformation x prime equals ax plus b over cx plus d, where a, b, c, d, and x are all p-adic numbers, then this operation leaves the graph distance invariant. So you know, I choose two points and two other points, and that specifies these guys. And now I act on the coordinates of the tree, which each point is labeled by two p-adic numbers. I act on all such p-adic numbers with this transformation, then it leaves the graph distance invariant, which means that this is a subgroup of the isometry group of the tree, which I can give a name to. And the name is PGL2QP, where QP is the p-adic numbers. Space of 2x2 matrices with p-adic elements of the matrices, and then it's projective because clearly it's just this ratio that ever matters. Okay, so this is a subgroup of the symmetry of the tree, and this is the analog of the conformal group in the Sitter space. Is this? And actually, it's the ability to write this formula in this way, which is why I chose p to be prime. It's why I introduce the p-adic numbers at all, because it's a very compact way to describe how the tree transforms a subset of the isometries. Okay, so there ends the machinery building, and now we can actually solve the model. Okay, so now I'll just draw this again one more time, because I need to have this up all the time. So let's just pick some bulk points. So we'll call this one A, this one B, and this one C. Then the operators that I'm going to be interested in, I'm going to call pi n of A, where what this operator does is it's 1 if the color at node A is n, and it's 0 otherwise. So it's a projection operator. And then I can compute correlation functions, say pi n1 of a1 dot dot dot, pi n, m of am. And then this is the joint probability that at node a sub n, you have color n sub n, m, sorry, a sub m, you have color n sub m. You know, at A1, you have color n sub 1, and so on and so forth. So this is going to be my definition of the correlation function in the bulk. Okay. So the main dynamical point about these correlators is that two guys here are correlated only to the extent that they share a common ancestor somewhere. So for example, if you start with two guys which are very close to each other, their common ancestor is right back here, then if the decay rate is small, then whatever is going on here is very likely to be the same as whatever is going on here, because most likely both of these have the same color as their ancestor, because the gamma is small. But then the further you go back on the tree with their common ancestor, the more time you have had to make some sort of transition, and less, you know, since it's stochastic, that means that they're less correlated. So we can imagine that the correlation will decrease as a function of the distance to the path to the common ancestor. So we can be a little more concrete about that. We can define a propagator, P N M, and let's call it of delta U. So I'm going to define this as the thing which you act on the probability distribution here with to get the probability distribution at some, you know, descendant of this which lives delta u time steps later. So from the equations, which unfortunately I now erased, it should be fairly clear that you do that by just raising the matrix G to the delta U power. You push the Markov evolution, you just push the probability up from the ancestor to the descendant. So this quantity is indeed G to the delta U MN. And we can write that in terms of the eigenvectors of the matrix M that I defined before. So E to the SM minus SN over 2, sum over the eigenvectors lambda I to the delta U, I M I N. So this is just taking the matrix G. These guys are the similarity transformation that turns it into the matrix M. And now I'm just expressing the matrix M to the power delta U in the basis of its eigenvectors. Okay. So the reason for introducing this notation is that now it's easy to say I want to compute the two-point function of A and C. Okay. So then, so let's call that pi N of A, pi M of C. So then this is just, so you go back to their common ancestor. Their common ancestor, say it has some color R, but that color R is taken from a probability distribution here. So it's, you sum on R, you take the probability distribution, which I'll just define in a second for R, and then you have P N R of UA minus U ancestor, which I'll call the time of the common ancestor, which I call U naught, and then PMR of UB minus U naught. Let me just be explicit about that. This is time U naught here. Okay, and then this is the answer. You take the probability distribution for the ancestor, and then you just evolve it up to this point and up to this point using the propagator, and you can just forget about everything else that happens in the tree. Okay? So now I have to say what this probability distribution is. So I wrote 0 here, and the reason is because I'm assuming that whatever the separation between these points is, it's small enough that their common ancestor lies long after the initial conditions, meaning that whatever the original probability distribution was, I've now got to the stationary attractor, which is given by thermal equilibrium, which means I can just replace this by e to the sr over this normalization constant that I introduced before. Okay? And now it's clear that you can compute everything. So maybe I'll, let's see how am I doing on time. Maybe I will just be a little bit expedient. It turns out that this correlator is not quite the nicest one to compute. What you actually want to do, so this is how you compute a bulk correlator, and it's clear that you can apply this to more. But you eventually want to compute things up at future infinity. And you also want to compute, for reasons that I'll explain a little bit more, operators which turn out to be conformal primaries. So I'm going to define a new operator, O of x, where x is a p-adic number, which is the limit as a goes to x in QP, which just means I take the point A on the tree and I push it up to the future boundary. And then I introduce some lambda I of minus U of A. So this is what I call, this is wave function renormalization. So if you do ADS CFT, you know about this. This is extrapolate. And then finally, I'm going to change basis in the operators that I'm interested in. I n pi n of A. And then finally, divide, multiply by square root of n. So now what this is doing is this is just changing to the eigenvector basis. So you could say this projection operator was in the color basis. I'm just doing a linear transformation on those operators to introduce operators with where the coefficients are given by the eigenvectors, to define an operator which is labeled by the eigenvector of the rate equation instead of labeled by the color. So there's nc colors and there's nc eigenvectors of the matrix. So this is certainly a transformation you can do. So this is what we might call the eigen basis, okay? And then this is just a convenient normalization factor. So why is this convenient? Why did I do this? Well, certainly if you were doing ADS-CFT or DS-CFT, you would do this extrapolation and you would remove this factor. The reason why I introduced this is because now the correlator becomes something truly nice. OJ of Y is just delta IJ, and then divided by P to the minus 2 U naught delta I, where I defined lambda I to be P to the minus delta I. So this is the definition. And then this I can now recognize from my definition of the p-adic norm as delta IJ over the p-adic distance between x and y to the 2 delta I. And this is exactly what you would have gotten from a conformal field theory, with the distance replaced by a p-adic number. So it's diagonal in the operator dimensions, which is something that you need. It falls off like a power, where the power is given by the conformal dimension. I won't go through the algebra, but it just consists of you use the orthogonality of the eigenvectors and sum over all the indices in sight, and you get this result. This is a standard form of the two-point function. I should make a few comments about it. The diagonality needed detailed balance. So this is something that Douglas figured out. So if I hadn't imposed detailed balance on the rate matrix, this correlator would not have ended up being diagonal in the operator dimension. Now that's not obvious, of course. You have to do the computation, but it's true. So apparently the condition of detailed balance is intimately related to the emergence of this conformal symmetry. There are certainly cases where I don't. So I told you we can incorporate things which can't uptunnel. If nothing uptunnels, then that makes life more difficult. But we should postpone that until after the talk because that's a whole can of worms. So a second comment is that this matrix G, well, I guess it's been erased for a while now, but this matrix G, let me put it down here. So G was equal to 1 plus something that was of order gamma, because there was the rate matrix was Pn of u plus 1 equals Pn of u plus stuff that's proportional to the decay rate, which means that if you look at it, so that the eigenvectors of G will also be 1 plus order gamma, which means that this delta is order gamma. So the conformal dimensions of these operators, when decay rates are small, the conformal dimensions are extremely small. So you could say highly relevant, very close to zero. Usually we think decay rates are like e to the minus, 30 or something. So and that's the size of the dimensions of these operators. And then finally, one more comment before I talk about higher point functions is that the fact that this correlator, so I presented this as the result of a detailed computation, but actually this form follows from PGL to QP. So if you work out how this operator transforms under PGL to QP, you can figure it out from this formula. And that gives you some kind of, if you do a transformation, x prime equals f of x, where f is a PGL2 transformation, then the O prime of x prime ends up being df dx to the minus delta I of O of X. So this is exactly the conformal primary transformation law from conformal field theory. And the group is, the formal structure of the group is the same. It's SL2 in both cases. So the diagonality and the position dependence are fixed by this sort of word identity for the same reason as it is in a conventional conformal field theory. Okay, so almost there. I just want to say a little bit about the higher correlation functions now. Okay, so actually the higher order correlation functions are easy because it turns out that there's an operator product expansion, OI of X, OJ of Y, is equal to sum of K, CI, JK. But now with the p-adic distance, delta K minus delta I minus delta J times OK of Y. So then if you use, write down any higher order, higher point correlation function that you want, and then reduce it to a two-point function by applying this OPE, and that gives you the correlation functions. So I've now described to you how to compute the higher order correlation functions. Of course, I didn't prove it to you. You have to do computations of this type to convince yourself of it, but the result is so easy to state that it's not worth going through it. But I need to say that this CIJK, so this is what you might call the structure constant, is given by a sum over R e to the minus SR over 2 I of R J R K R. Okay? So this is the formula in terms of the eigenvectors of M and the entropies. Oh, and technically there's a square root of that normalization constant that I talked about before in there. Important not to forget that. Okay, so this seems like a reasonable candidate for CFT on the p-adic numbers. It's a set of correlation functions. The correlators, the two-point function has the conformal symmetry, and then because the OPE has the same structure that you get in conformal field theory, for example, the three-point function has the usual form, the four-point function has the usual form with harmonic ratios, and everything is hunky-dory. Good, so I was actually about to say something about that. But let me make one other comment first. So first, I'll just note that this, when the entropy differences are large between the different vacua, then some CIJKs are much greater than one. So these correlators are very non-Gaussian. So you might say this is a strongly coupled theory. Secondly, as you just pointed out, no descendants. So this is a big difference from conformal field theory. The reason that there are no descendants is because the space at the future boundary is discrete. And it turns out that the p-adic distance on future infinity is what we call ultrametric, meaning that all triangles are tall isosceles. And it turns out that that allows you to have a consistent conformal structure without needing to have descendants. Actually, it's hard even to make sense of derivatives. So the derivative of O doesn't seem to mean very much. The theory just seems to be happy on its own without needing any descendants to produce correlators that transform covariantly under PGL2. Okay, and then finally one more comment. So then these C's obey some sort of associativity type rule. K C K L M equals N C I K N C J M N. So what this rule does for you is when you compute there are certain cases where you could have done the OPE in two different ways to compute the correlator. Those are the cases where some of the triangles are equilateral. And then the fact that you get the same answer computing the correlator in two different ways requires this property. So it's something like the associativity of the OPE in conformal field theory, although it's not really quite, you can't really quite call it that, but it's something like that, and it serves a similar purpose. So that's all I had to say about the model. Now I can say a little bit about what I think we might have learned from this model that could be applied to cosmology and internal inflation, but first let me just make sure there aren't any more questions about the model. Okay. Okay, so I think the main nice thing here is that it seems that eternal inflation via bubble nucleation can fit into the idea of a conformal theory at future infinity. You know, you might have thought, oh, you know, De Sitter space with bubble nucleation is, you know, the boundary is sort of, you know, violently shredded by all of these bubble nucleations. You know, it's very different from ADS where you have nice Dirichlet boundary conditions and nothing is happening at the boundary. And maybe you wouldn't be able to really, maybe you can't really have a conformal field theory. Well, here there's at least some kind of conformal field theory which is allowed to live at future infinity. I should add that this is actually the second model to support this kind of conclusion. This is for a legal comment. The first was a model by Ben Freivogel and Matt Kleben from a couple of years ago, which was in some ways more realistic and in some ways less realistic than this model. They had to specify to a very specific kind of landscape. But on the other hand, they were able to think about they had a continuous model rather than a discrete model. But in some sense, this model has a lot more flexibility. You can think about a much more general landscape. You can also include terminals in a simple way, although I didn't describe it to you here. But I think it really, it's a nice self-contained simple thing which you can really solve the crap out of. Secondly, now I'll say two more things which unfortunately I didn't have time to say to you today because time is finite. About the terminals, so the terminals end up breaking the conformal symmetry. When you put in the ADS and the lambda equals zero vacua, the correlators are no longer CFT correlators, but they still scale in a simple way. They transform under conformal transformations in a simple but not covariant way. And they still have an operator product, which can compute all of the correlation functions. So what that means about the continuum theory is unclear. It's something I'm working on now. But at least it's possible to fit them into this framework. And then finally, this model sort of, the time that's very natural in this model of going up is analogous in the bulk to what's called light cone time, which is interesting because people who think about eternal inflation spend a lot of time worrying about which time slicing is good. I mean, it seems like any time slicing should be good because of general covariance. But at least in this model, the light cone time is on a very special footing. It's the only time that respects the causal structure of the model. At least it's some circumstantial evidence saying that light cone time is a good thing to think about. Things to improve, and here I'll stop. How is this related to the continuum model? This is just a lattice model. This is work in progress. It is related to the continuum theory, but in a perhaps surprising way that we haven't completely understood yet. Very importantly, can we include quantum mechanics into this? So this was just a stochastic model. We were just, plopping down things with some probability, but that's supposed to be modeling Coleman-DeLucia decays, which are supposed to be something about path integrals and wave functions or something like them. So can you somehow include quantum mechanics in a more honest way into this model, or if not, why not? And then finally, what does this model have to say about, things with names like DS-CFT and FRW-CFT? Certainly it says that the effects of the landscape probably should be thought about in terms of a large set of low-dimension operators, very low-dimension operators. But in detail, how do you implement that? How do you build those operators out of bulk fields? Those are all questions that I don't know the answer to at the moment. I'd like to, and things that I'm hoping to think about. Okay, so I think I'll stop there. Thanks a lot.